Okay, we are now recording. Hear ye, this Honorable Appellate Court for the Second Judicial District is now in session. The Honorable Anne B. Jorgensen presiding. Your Honors, the first case on the docket this morning is 2-21-0371, the people of the state of Illinois, plaintiff appellee v. Deontay House, defendant appellant. Arguing on behalf of the appellant, Ms. Anna C. Carlozzi. Arguing on behalf of the appellee, Ms. Leslie Martin.
All right, are both sides ready to proceed?
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, then you may proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. Again, for the record, Anna Carlozzi with the Office of the State Appellate Defender on behalf of Deontay House. The question posed in this case is a simple one. Did Deontay House understand how his pre-plea custody credit would be applied to his sentence? The answer here is also a simple one, no. And a dispassionate read of the record reveals this. It also reveals that Mr. House's number one concern when he pled guilty was his pre-plea credit and how that would be applied to his sentence. Shortly into
In your briefs, you set out the discussion at the trial or at the hearing, and the transcript at the hearing. I believe it was you that set that out. Yes, and at the hearing on the plea, at the sentencing hearing, or at his plea hearing, he seemed to understand. The judge said he's receiving credit for 1,052 actual days. I think the state said that. I can't be any more clear, and the court asked the defendant, does that answer your question? And he said, yes, Your Honor. So at the plea hearing, he seemed pretty clear at that point that he understood the number of days he was going to get. Were we looking at his subjective understanding of what was going on? And is that what we should be looking at here?
Well, so Mr. House understood that he spent 1,052 days in custody before he pled guilty. And so that's why when the state said he's getting credit for 1,052 actual days, Mr. House understood that that meant that he spent 1,052 actual days in custody. What he was confused about was how those 1,052 days were going to be applied to his sentence. Because he thought that they were going to be applied, to his sentence day for day. And so this is his subjective belief, but there are objective circumstances explaining why or showing that his subjective belief was understandable. His subjective misunderstanding, I guess, was understandable in this case.
So what you're relying on here is ineffective assistance of counsel, basically, I see throughout your brief. You have the two-prong standard that you have to show us in Strickland, which was the conduct of the attorney, basically, and prejudice. Tell us how you are going to prove that to Your Honors.
Prejudice or ineffective assistance? I'm sorry.
Well, either.
So in this case, at the hearing on his motion to vacate, Mr. House did testify that his attorney told him he was going to get day for day credit. He testified, I took the time, meaning he pled guilty, because that's what he, meaning his counsel, told me. He said, you're going to get day for day. And so Mr. House's attorney told him he was going to get day for day credit.
According to Mr. House, did the attorney ever admit or say, yeah, that's what I told him?
He did not. He was not called to testify at the hearing on the motion. But Mr. House's misunderstanding is, and the fact that his counsel contributed to his misunderstanding is supported by the plea transcripts. Because during the plea hearing, his attorney confirmed that yes, his credit was going to be day for day. So So Mr. House said, Your Honor, yes, I'm just making sure that that credit was day for day. The court said, all right, now is that, and then his attorney said 1,052 actual days.
Right.
The court said, that's what it's been represented. Mr. House said, credit for day, right? The court said, yeah, correct. And then Mr. House's attorney said, yes, sir, when the court asked that. And so again, this is also why the state attempting to clarify that Mr. House was receiving 1,052 actual days was not actually clarifying, because it's clear that Mr. House was told by his attorney that he was going to get credit for 1,052 actual days, but also his attorney told him that those days were going to be credited day for day.
Where's the prejudice?
The prejudice lies in the fact that this was Mr. House's number one concern while he was pleading guilty. He asked the question not once, but twice. He asked it at the very beginning of his plea and then after his plea was accepted. And so that shows that this was one of his number one priorities, was one of the most important factors was how much time was going to be taken off of his ultimate sentence based on the time he had already served.
If we allow him to withdraw his plea and proceed to trial, what is he facing?
On this charge, 9 to 40 years.
Just one charge. How many charges were dismissed as a result of this plea? Three charges.
Yeah. Were any of those other charges consecutive, or were they all concurrent?
That I don't recall if they were consecutive or concurrent. I believe that they were concurrent.
I'd like to just focus this a little bit more. Let's assume for the sake of argument that your client agreed that he had the 1,052 actual days, but in his mind, based on all of this dialogue and what his attorney told him, he thinks he's getting 2,000 and some days credit. Okay, let's assume that's a mistake. Where can we look at the totality of what would be reinstated here and conclude that there would have been any rational basis to turn down 9.5 years given what he was facing? That's the prejudice question, and if you would address that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's clear that this was his number one concern, and the record shows that he was unlikely to have pled guilty if he had known how his pre-plea credit was going to be applied.
Right, but the question is there a rational basis for him to have turned down 9.5 given what his potential sentence on all five of the charges that were there, and the fact that counsel had done a motion to suppress the statement, I believe, where he basically admitted it's my stuff and I'm transporting it for cash. Given all of that, where can we rationally conclude that he would have rejected or should have rejected this offer and proceeded to trial?
I mean, I think you can conclude that based on his questions. When someone is looking to withdraw their plea based on misrepresentations of counsel, the question isn't what would be the likelihood at trial or would he have been successful. The question is, would he have pled guilty or not?
That's why I talked to you about the two prongs of Strickland. You also have to show that there was prejudice, as Justice Jorgensen is getting to. Where is the prejudice when he could have most likely gone to prison on all five of those cases for a very long time, as opposed to the sentence he received? Where's the prejudice?
Well, the prejudice is that he wouldn't have pled guilty, and I recognize that Mr. House got a good deal here, but he may have, if he had known the true way the credit was going to be applied to his sentence, he may have just favored taking a long shot at trial. But
if that's an irrational decision, there's no prejudice. And that's the point. I mean, he's got a criminal history. He's pretty near the minimum of the Class X sentencing. It would be irrational. That would be the argument, I guess, by the state to suggest that he should roll the bones when he's getting almost the minimum sentence and potentially face a much longer sentence. And it's not just rolling the bones, it's jumping over a cliff, knowing what the result is given his admissions and the evidence. So how is it rational to suggest that if he had known he was gonna be shorted some of this credit that he supposedly believes he's gonna get, it's not rational? I guess that's the question, the prejudice question.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's just clear that Mr. House would have preferred to just take his chances at trial.
Now, is his subjective preference our analysis, or is it what an objective person would rationally do? Which one of those two standards are we to employ?
I mean, I think we have to look at a rational person, but also look at Mr. House himself. Because it's just clear from the record that, I mean, he didn't even seem happy with pleading guilty to begin with. He stopped the proceeding several times before he agreed to a 402 conference. He asked for a 401 conference. He had cycled through several attorneys. And based on my reading of the record, it was because all those other attorneys told him that he should plead guilty, and it seemed like he didn't want to plead guilty. And so it's clear that Mr. House would have just favored taking a long shot. And in the 2017 Supreme Court case, I think People versus Lee, the United States Supreme Court found that in that case, the defendant had pled guilty, did not realize that he was going to have to be deported from pleading guilty. And the Supreme Court vacated his plea, finding basically that, sure, it's likely that he would have been found guilty, but if he favored taking that long shot at trial because of the ramifications of the deportation, then that was kind of his call. And so if that defendant was prejudiced in that way, then it seems as if Mr. House was also prejudiced here.
You know, you mentioned that Supreme Court case, which is a little different because it was misadvisal on a deportation. There's a whole host of those cases, so we know how the court's going to go on that. You cited it in your brief. How do you distinguish the Brown case, which is our Illinois Supreme Court?
I don't remember the facts of the Brown case right now.
It was basically... Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I apologize. I don't remember the specific facts of that case right now.
Basically, what the Illinois Supreme Court talks about and focuses on that prejudice prong in withdrawing of a plea. In the Brown case, they basically said that defendant, as Justice Brennan was saying, basically had no likelihood of success at a trial. So where is the prejudice prong? And they affirmed the case when the trial court denied the motion to withdraw the plea. I think you're getting hung up, Ms. Carlozzi, on the part of the first prong of Strickland, but it is the burden of the defendant to prove both prongs of Strickland, the ineffective assistance in addition to the prejudice that has to be shown. And I have yet to hear the prejudice with respect to your client, should he have been allowed to withdraw this plea. I mean, I know what the prejudice is. I'm asking you.
I mean, the prejudice is that, I mean, he would not have pled guilty and he would have taken his chances.
Mary, you're mute.
How successful do you think he would have been on taking that chance? That's the question.
I'm not sure. I mean, part of his plea was also that he thought his attorney, part of his motion to withdraw his plea focused on various motions he wanted his attorneys to file. I agree that he would not have had great he might not have had great success at trial because the evidence seems pretty strong. But if someone who had access to the fuller record, you know, police reports, things like that, maybe that I don't have access to. And moreover, again, the question here is not, because that's when it's a question of trial strategy. The question is, what would have been the success at trial? When it comes to these consequences of pleading guilty, the question is, would he have pled guilty? And the answer here is a clear no, he would not have pled guilty.
Okay, thank you. I have no further questions, Justice.
Justice Brennan, anything else?
No, thank you.
Counsel, thank you. And you will have an opportunity for a rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
When you're ready.
Okay. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Leslie Martin, and I appear on behalf of the state, the appellee in this case. It is the state's position that the issue on appeal is whether the trial court erred in denying defendant's motion to withdraw his guilty plea. But as Your Honors so astutely honed in on the ineffective assistance of counsel issue, I'll start there first and then get to, you know, another type of analysis that this court could approach the issue upon. However, no matter which analysis this court relies upon, the defendant has failed to meet his burden either way. Speaking specifically to the Strickland standard and the two prongs that Your Honors mentioned before, the first prong, which I will call the deficient performance prong, and the second prong being a showing of prejudice, it's the defendant's burden, talking first about the prejudice prong, to show that there's a reasonable probability that but for the alleged errors, or in this case, his allegation that his counsel informed him that his pre-sentence credit would be doubled, would, because of those alleged errors, he would have insisted on going to trial or stated otherwise, that the decision to reject the plea would have been rational. And the defendant has not met that burden. Firstly, a defendant's conclusory allegations that he would have not pleaded guilty and would have demanded a trial is insufficient to establish prejudice, and the state cites Brown in our brief to support that position. And here, that's all that we have is defendant's own subjective testimony that that's what he would have done, and that's insufficient. Also,
Ms. Carlozzi relies on the Boyd decision out of the Fifth District? Yes, the Fifth District, that basically the facts are quite on point with the facts here. And that court found that if the defendant was prejudiced by counsel's deficient performance, by the defendant saying if he had known he wasn't eligible to get good time credit, he'd have never pled guilty. How do you distinguish that case, Ms. Kett?
So, but Boyd is distinguishable from the instant case for two reasons. Firstly, in that case, and as defense counsel mentioned earlier, we don't have in this case any subpoena from the defendant to produce the testimony from his plea counsel to provide the best and strongest objective evidence of what his counsel told him prior to him agreeing to plead guilty. And in Boyd, there was testimony from counsel supporting the defendant's claims, and the Fifth District relied upon that objective evidence in finding that the defendant had shown he had been misinformed. And secondly, Boyd is distinguishable because there, according to my recollection of the facts, the defendant pled guilty to, I believe, 18 years, whereas the sentencing range for the offense was between 6 and, I don't even remember what the maximum, but the minimum was 6 years. So in essence, the court found that he essentially agreed to a sentence 12 years higher than what he could have received had he not pled guilty. And in this case, as Your Honors have mentioned, the defendant here, by pleading guilty, he was only pleading guilty to one offense and he was charged with 6. And for that one offense that he was sentenced on, he received a sentence of 9.5 years. So only 6 months more than the minimum. And that's, you know, one of the strongest reasons why the state finds the defendant has failed to show prejudice. And there's also another very strong indication from the record that defendant has failed to show that he would have insisted in going to trial. And that is the defendant's own comments. The trial court noted in its decision, and it's, if Your Honors are looking for it, it's on pages 451 to about 455 of the record, but the defendant expressed strong apprehension for the state describing more of the underlying facts when the state was presenting its factual basis for the plea, because the defendant was, you know, very worried about these underlying facts being published in a public record, because he said that this could have put himself or his family in harm's way. So the defendant, you know, gives us himself an understanding of his motivations for accepting the plea, in which the state finds that the defendant himself has shown us that he would not have desired to go to trial.
If I could just confirm, the other charges that were dismissed, they were all concurrent, not consecutive, correct?
Yeah, I'm not sure, Your Honor, but I believe that may be true.
I only asked because it's, I mean, to point out that four or five other charges were dismissed isn't particularly relevant if they're concurrent and he's pled to a class X with extended sentencing. I mean, he has pled to the most time he could potentially plead to in terms of exposure. So the dismissal of the other counts isn't changing that dynamic. Is that fair?
I think it is relevant in the sense that we had defendant gone to trial, he could have been convicted on any one of these offenses or all of them. And, you know, that just adds more variety to the question of would defendant have received a more favorable outcome had he gone to trial? And we can't say that. I mean, 9 years was the minimum just for that offense, but there are other class X offenses that, you know, had other sentencing ranges.
But none of them would have had a minimum greater than 9 years though, correct?
Not to my recollection, but I don't know what the sentencing ranges were for the other offenses. I only know about the one that he pled guilty to, but look, I think that other convictions are always relevant to questions about sentencing.
Sure. So let me ask this, as it relates to the first prong of Strickland, we do have, you know, Walker was not called. So we do have in one sense, just the defendant's subjective argument, but it's kind of corroborated by the number of times the defendant stopped the plea. I mean, four or five times he stopped the plea, and according to, and that's in the record. And he says those times, I think with one exception, he's talking about how to calculate this sentencing credit. Doesn't that provide some kind of objective corroboration in terms of the defendant's subjective understanding?
No, Your Honor, the state would argue that that only provides speculation as to what the defendant's understanding was, especially given that every time that he had these, you know, off the record conversations with his counsel, at the point in which the parties came back and the hearing resumed, there was never any sort of question brought up as to how much pre-sentencing credit the defendant would be receiving, because as is the state's position, it was always clear that the defendant would only be receiving credit for 1,052 days. And furthermore, it's the state's position that every time the question of day-for-day credit was brought up by defendant, it was always and only clarified that 1,052 days was the amount of time that the defendant would be receiving. I think it's also...
there was at one point when the judge said something, I think Ms. Carlozzi had cited that, where the judge said something...
day-for-day.
Yeah, about day-for-day.
Yes. And Your Honors, I would also like to point out that the meaning of day for day in this context simply meant that for every day that the defendant had spent in county jail, you know, leading up to his plea, that would have been counted as one day counted towards his sentence served in the Department of Correction. So
you would concede, though, that if somebody has some familiarity with the sentencing schemes in Illinois, and this defendant was not a newbie, if you will, that day for day is a term of art, meaning essentially I'm only going to have to serve half my time, or in his interpretation here, or misinterpretation, I'm going to get double time. I mean, day for day is a term of art. It's not, we're not going to look to the dictionary for what it means.
But Your Honor, the state's not conceding that point in this case. I think as one of your, I can't remember which person mentioned before, but it's the totality of the circumstances that matter here. And where there were clear instructions or instructions is the wrong word, but clear, a clear summary by the state of, you know, all of the terms that went along with this plea agreement, which only included 1,052 days. And defendant, when he was asked by the trial court, had he been promised anything other than what the state had summarized, the defendant said no. He also was asked, did he understand? And the defendant said yes. So considering
is the defendant's subjective understanding what we go by here?
No, it is an objective understanding in this case that we go by.
Counsel, so, let me ask you this. How do you figure out day for day?
So, Your Honors, you know, the sentencing and the credits and all of those numbers, you know, that's why in the state's brief, I made a point of talking about this as being a collateral consequence, because the only reason that we're even discussing this in this appeal is to the extent that the defendant is alleging that his plea counsel misinformed him about such collateral consequence. But otherwise, anything related to a collateral consequence, being good time credit or anything of the like, was never something that the state, the trial court, or anyone at this point in time could have guaranteed the defendant, because those are all things within the powers of the Department of Corrections.
Here's my question. If you're going to figure out day for day, you start with the actual days and then you multiply it by two. So repeatedly telling him that that was the actual days, that really didn't impact the total number of day for day. If that's objectively, if we look at what the trial court says to him, and credit day for day, right? And the trial court says, yes, correct. So we keep telling him it's actual days, and he's not disputing that. He's just saying, yeah, I get 1,000 days in, day for day means we're gonna double it. And as Justice Brennan said, that's a word of art. If you've been through the system, you know exactly what day for day means.
Your Honor, I think what is particularly, you know, helpful for that kind of question is the fact that the state also clarified, you know, I think the state did have some sense that, you know, there was a need to further clarify, and the state clarified after, I can't remember exactly which incident, but that the defendant would be serving his sentence at 75% and not 50. So I think that also, you know, clears up any room for misunderstanding there.
Right. Well, he knew that he was going in, that it was 75% that he was going to serve from that point forward. His issue is that for the time I'd already served, I was going to get day for day. And when the state clarifies, he says, again, I want to make sure that it's 1,052 actual days. Again, nobody talks about day for day.
Your Honor, but I would also point out that no one ever mentioned anything about 104 days. And also in this case, you know, it's the defendant's burden to prove that that his misinterpretation was objectively reasonable. And we don't have anything in this case, whether that's plea counsel's testimony, the trial transcripts don't clearly reflect that, as I've mentioned before. Nor does defendant's subjective testimony, you know, prove that. And I would also like to point out, as the trial court found and kind of made some sort of credibility determination, and this is why the state's position is actually that the issue isn't per se one of ineffective assistance of counsel. Ineffective assistance of counsel is one layer of this issue, but the real issue is whether the trial court erred in denying defendant's motion to withdraw his guilty plea. That's the issue that defense counsel lays out in their brief. With that being the issue on appeal, the standard of review is actually one of abuse of discretion. And therefore, we can rely upon the credibility findings of the trial court, in which they found that, you know, defendant's accusation regarding ineffective assistance of counsel was unfounded. They found that defendant's later allegations that he was pressured by his counsel into accepting his guilty plea were unfounded, where prior to the plea being accepted and being asked by the trial court, did he make this voluntarily, the defendant said yes. And even the defendant's comment that because of diabetes and COVID that he was under some kind of, you know, medical illness or inability to fully understand, where the defendant said prior to his plea being accepted that, you know, he was having no impact to his ability to comprehend, but later said that he was, the trial court found that all unfounded. And we can rely upon those credibility findings of the trial court, where it was the same trial court judge present for the plea hearings as it was for the hearing on the motion to withdraw the guilty plea.
Now, what did the minimus show?
that. So you're talking about the judgment order? That he would receive 973 days for credit for time served in the Kane County Jail and 79 days for La Crosse County Jail, which amounts to 1,052 days. So once again, 1,052 days is the only, you know, number of days that was ever mentioned by any party. And the defendant never mentioned 2,104 days. It's the defendant's burden, and the defendant has not met his burden.
And defendant was shown that order. Correct.
I can't recall specifically whether the defendant was shown this order. It certainly is in the common law record, but we have numerous instances, as your honors are aware of the transcript from the plea hearing, in which the defendant was repeatedly told about 1,052 days, and he even admitted himself that he had heard that amount. So we have no reason here to believe that the defendant could have objectively formed any misinterpretation, excuse me, of what his pre-sentencing credit would be. This is a collateral consequence that we're even discussing and is only relevant to the extent defendant has proven that that his counsel misinformed him. I see my time has expired. So to the extent your honors have any additional questions, I ask this court to affirm the judgment of the trial court below.
Do you have any additional questions? Justice Brennan?
No, thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. And are you ready to proceed with your rebuttal?
Yes. Just a couple points. I'd like to point out in the state's order, first I'd like to point out that in the state's brief, in the state's response brief, it argued that this was a de novo review because the state did, or excuse me, the court did issue an order granting the state motion for directed verdict after the hearing on the motion to withdraw. But the court issued another order in which it dismissed Mr. House's petition. And in that order, he said he admits that he incorrectly advised Mr. House. The court said, when the defendant asked whether he was getting credit for day, I stated that was my understanding of the plea. So he admits that he misinformed Mr. House about how his credit was going to be applied. And then at every other point in the order, it says that someone clarified or that Mr. House agreed that his sentence would have to be served at 75%. And so no one ever, even in the court's order, it's clear that no one ever actually clarified for Mr. House that he was not going to get day-for-day credit. The easiest way to clarify that would have been to say, why are we talking about day-for-day credit? Day-for-day credit means 50%.
I want to make sure we're on the same page. We all agree. Yes. That there's no such thing as day for day credit for time you've already served. You get a sentence and it's either served day for day, which means 50% roughly, or in this case, 75%. So we take 9.5 years, we get 75% of it, and we get a certain amount of days. After that, the defendant gets, as the judge told him, credit for 1,052 actual days. That is a correct statement, objectively. Would you agree with that?
Yes, but I think that the way you explained it is much, much more clear than the way that the court explained it, right?
Well, I would agree with that, but yeah. Objectively, the objectively, the language that the judge ultimately used when there was an attempt to clarify, and more particularly the language of the state, it was correct. Is that fair?
Mr. House was getting credit for 1,052 days, and he said that he understood that that was the credit. What he did not understand is how it applied. And
that's his misunderstanding. That's his subjective misunderstanding. Show me a case that says if it's his subjective misunderstanding, then he should be allowed to withdraw his plea.
I mean, I don't have a case that says specifically that off the top of my head, but what I'm saying is that there are objective circumstances that support that why he had this subjective misunderstanding.
Well, let me ask you this. In this transcript, the judge says, is that correct, Mr. Merkel? I'm assuming that's the prosecutor. And the state says, judge, He's receiving credit for 1,052 actual days. I can't be any more. I don't know that there's any way to put it any more clearly than that. Also, then fast forward to the end of the hearing at, I think the record is at 216, where the judge shows him the form, and the defendant is to serve the following periods of incarceration. And the form shows the Department of Corrections, 9.5 years. Under that, it also indicates credit for time served, 1,052 actual days. The judge showed that form to the defendant in open court and asked the defendant if his name appeared on that form. And he said, yes, it did. So, I mean, how much clearer can anyone be with respect to the number of days, regardless of had in his mind that he was going to get doubled? Who misled him?
Well, his attorney misled him, because that's part of it. He testified that his attorney told him he was going to get day for day.
His attorney told him that, the court and the prosecutor, it seems, made clear that he was going to get credit for 1,052 actual days. What made him think he shouldn't believe them?
Well, I think that he understood that his credit was 1,052 days. He did not understand how that credit was going to be applied. And so he understood that that was the amount of days he spent in custody, but he just did not, he thought that because he was going to get day for day, that it was going to be doubled.
Well, he thought wrong. So then what do we do?
Allow him to withdraw his plea, or, you know, reverse the court's order denying his motion. Because it's clear that, I mean, he asked the question the first time, and the question, obviously, before the factual basis and all that, it's clear that his question was not answered, because he asked the same question again. And the parties answered it in the same way. And his counsel again gave him a misrepresentation at some point. I don't know if it was during the plea on one of the occasions that they went off the record, or if it was before the plea. And that's shown by the fact that his attorney agreed on the record that it was day for day. I know that I'm out of time, but I did want to touch on the prejudice prong quickly, because Brown does say when the claim is related to the client's understanding of the consequences of a guilty plea, the reviewing court must consider the circumstances surrounding the plea, including assessing the consequences of conviction by either trial or plea, right? So, and yes, Mr. House was on this offense, was facing, up to 40 years in prison, but he had other offenses that had lower minimums than 9. And so taking all the circumstances surrounding the plea, the fact that he did not seem too thrilled to be pleading guilty to begin with, that he stopped the proceeding several times, that he later claimed that his attorney pressured him to plead guilty, telling him he was a burden on his family, telling him that he was going to get the maximum amount of time, all these things, plus his misunderstanding about how his credit was going to be applied, all of those circumstances, even though he could have been facing more time if he had gone to trial, all of those circumstances support the fact that he probably would have not agreed to plead guilty. He would have insisted on going to trial, and he would have just taken that long shot. And if there are no other questions, we ask that this court reverse the trial court's denial of Mr. House's motion and allow him to vacate his plea.
Any additional questions, Justice Drastic? Justice Brennan?
Just one. Does the record suggest any reason for not subpoenaing the defense attorney, you know, evasion of service, difficulty, he died? Is there any suggestion why post-plea counsel did not attempt to do that in the record?
There's not any suggestion why. I would just point out that Mr. Walker was a private attorney. I don't know if he normally practices in Kane County, like I said, I know that Mr. House kind of cycled through a couple private attorneys. So I'm not, there's no reasoning in the record for why counsel did not call Mr. Walker.
I have no additional questions.
Post plea counsel.
Thank you.
I don't have any additional questions either. We thank both counsel for extraordinary arguments this morning, and we will issue a resolution in due course. Thank you both very much.
Thank you,
Your Honor.